Chapter 51, The Treasure of Insight. When the 13th retreat seat 13th retreat season ended, the Buddha returned to Savatthi. Svasti and Rahula followed him. It was the first time Svasti had been to Jetavana Monastery. He was delighted to discover how beautiful and inviting a place it was to practice. Jetavana was cool, refreshing, and friendly. Everyone smiled warmly at Svasti. They knew that the sutra-tending water buffaloes had been inspired by him. Svasti was confident that in so supportive an environment, he would make great progress in his practice. He was beginning to understand why the Sangha was as important as the Buddha and the Dharma. Sangha was the community of persons practicing the way of awareness. It provided support and guidance. It was necessary to take refuge in the Sangha. Rahula turned 20 years old, and Sariputta performed his ordination ceremony. He was now a fully ordained bhikkhu, and all the community rejoiced. Venerable Sariputta devoted several days prior to the ordination to give Rahula special teaching. Svasti accompanied him during these sessions, and so benefited from Sariputta's teaching as well. After Rahula's ordination, the Buddha also spent time to teach him different methods of contemplation. Svasti was invited to these sessions too. The Buddha taught them the contemplation on the 6 sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, on the 6 sense objects, forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, and objects of mind, and the 6 sense consciousnesses, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. The Buddha showed them how to look deeply into the impermanent nature of these 18 domains of sense, called the 18 dhatus, which comprise the 6 sense organs, the 6 sense objects, and the 6 sense consciousnesses, or internal objects of sense. Perceptions arose because of contact between a sense organ and a sense object. All the domains of sense depended on each other for existence. They were all impermanent and interdependent. If one could understand that, one could penetrate the truth of the emptiness of self and transcend birth and death. The Buddha gave Rahula the teaching on the emptiness of self in great detail. He said, "Rahula, among the 5 skandhas, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, there is nothing that can be considered to be permanent, and nothing that can be called a self. This body is not the self. This body is not something that belongs to the self either. The self cannot be found in the body, and the body cannot be found in the self. There are 3 kinds of views of self. The first is that this body is the self, or these feelings, perceptions, mental formations, or consciousness are the self. This is the belief in skandha as self, and it is the first wrong view. But when one says, the skandhas are not the self, one may fall into the second wrong view and believe that the self is something that exists independently from the skandhas, and that the skandhas are its possessions. This second wrong view is called skandha is different from the self. The third wrong view consists in the belief that there is a presence of the self in the skandhas, and there is the presence of the skandhas in the self. This is called the belief in the presence of skandhas and self in each other. Rahula, practicing deeply the meditation on emptiness of the self means looking into the 5 skandhas in order to see that they are neither self, belonging to self, nor interbeing with self. Once we overcome these 3 wrong views, we can experience the true nature of emptiness of all dharmas. Svasti noticed how a bhikkhu at Jetavana named Tara never spoke to anyone else. He always walked alone. Venerable Tara did not disturb anyone, nor did he violate any precepts, and yet it seemed to Svasti that he did not live in genuine harmony with the rest of the community. Once Svasti tried to speak with him, but he walked away without responding. The other bhikkhus nicknamed him the one who lives alone. Svasti had often heard the Buddha encourage the bhikkhus to avoid idle talk, meditate more, and develop self-sufficiency. But Svasti felt that Venerable Tara was not living the kind of self-sufficiency the Buddha intended. Confused, Svasti decided to ask the Buddha about it. The next day, during his Dharma talk, the Buddha summoned the elder Tara. He asked him, "Is it true that you prefer to keep to yourself and that you do all things alone, avoiding contact with other bhikkhus?" The bhikkhu answered, "Yes, Lord, that is true. You have told us to be self-sufficient and to practice being alone." The Buddha turned to the community and said, "Bhikkhus, I will explain what true self-sufficiency is and what is the better way to live alone. A self-sufficient person is a person who dwells in mindfulness. He is aware of what is going on in the present moment, what is going on in his body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind. He knows how to look deeply at things in the present moment. He does not pursue the past nor lose himself in the future, because the past no longer is and the future has not yet come. Life can only take place in the present moment. If we lose the present moment, we lose life. This is the better way to live alone." Bhikkhus, what is meant by pursuing the past? To pursue the past means to lose yourself in thoughts about what you looked like in the past, what your feelings were then, what rank and position you held, what happiness or suffering you experienced then. Giving rise to such thoughts entangles you in the past. Bhikkhus, what is meant by losing yourself in the future? To lose yourself in the future means to lose yourself in thoughts about the future. You imagine, hope, fear, or worry about the future, wondering what you will look like, what your feelings will be, whether you will have happiness or suffering. Giving rise to such thoughts entangles you in the future. Bhikkhus, return to the present moment in order to be in direct contact with life and to see life deeply. If you cannot make direct contact with life, you cannot see deeply. Mindfulness enables you to return to the present moment. But if you are enslaved by desires and anxieties over what is happening in the present, you will lose your mindfulness and you will not be truly present to life. Bhikkhus, one who really knows how to be alone dwells in the present moment, even if he is sitting in the midst of a crowd. If a person sitting alone in the middle of a forest is not mindful, if he is haunted by the past and future, he is not truly alone. The Buddha then recited a gatha to summarize his teaching. Do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has not yet come. Looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must be diligent today. To wait until tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? The sage calls a person who knows how to dwell in mindfulness night and day, one who knows the better way to live alone. After reading the gatha, the Buddha thanked Thera and invited him to be seated again. The Buddha had neither praised nor criticized Thera, but it was clear that the bhikkhu now had a better grasp of what the Buddha meant by being self-sufficient or being alone. During the Dharma discussion that took place later that evening, Svasti listened to the senior disciples say how important the Buddha's words had been that morning. Venerable Ananda repeated the Buddha's discourse, including the gatha, word for word. Svasti was always amazed at Ananda's memory. Ananda even spoke with the same stress on words as the Buddha. When Ananda was finished, Mahakakana stood up and said, "I would like to suggest that we make a formal sutra of the Buddha's teaching this morning. I further suggest that we name it the Bhadakarata Sutra, the Sutra on Knowing the Better Way to Live Alone. Every bhikkhu should memorize this sutra and put it into practice." And voiced his support for Mahakakana's idea. The next morning, when the bhikkhus were out begging, they encountered a group of children playing by the rice paddies. The children had caught a crab, which one boy held down with his forefinger. With his other hand, he ripped one of the crab's claws off. The other children clapped their hands and squealed. Pleased with their reaction, the boy ripped the other claw off. Then he tore all the crab's legs off one by one. He tossed the crab back into the paddy and caught another one. When the children saw the Buddha and bhikkhus arrive, they bowed their heads and then returned to tormenting the next crab. The Buddha told the children to stop. He said, "Children, if someone ripped off your arm or leg, would it hurt?" "Yes, teacher," the children answered. "Do you know that crabs feel pain just as you do?" The children did not answer. The Buddha continued, "The crab eats and drinks just like you. It has parents, brothers, and sisters.
When you make it suffer, you make its family suffer as well. Think about what you're doing. The children appeared sorry for what they had done. Seeing that other villagers had gathered around to see what he and the children were talking about, the Buddha used the occasion to offer a teaching about compassion. He said, "Every living being deserves to enjoy a sense of security and well-being. We should protect life and bring happiness to others. All living beings, whether large or small, whether two-legged or four-legged, whether swimmers or flyers, have a right to live. We should not harm or kill other living beings. We should protect life. Children, just as a mother loves and protects her only child at the risk of her own life, we should open our hearts to protect all living beings. Our love should encompass every living being on, below, within, outside, and around us. Day and night, whether standing or walking, sitting or lying down, we should dwell in that love." The Buddha asked the children to release the crab they had caught. Then he told everyone, "Meditating on love in this way brings happiness first to the one who practices it. You sleep better and wake up more at ease. You do not have nightmares. You are neither sorrowful nor anxious, and you are protected by everyone and everything around you. Those people and beings you bring into your mind of love and compassion bring you great joy, and slowly their suffering leaves them." Svasti knew that the Buddha was committed to sharing the teaching with children. To help with that, he and Rahula organized special classes for children at Jetavana. With the assistance of young laypersons, especially Sudatta's four children, the young people gathered for special teaching once a month. Sudatta's son Kala was not very enthusiastic at first about attending. He only did so because he was fond of Svasti. But little by little his interest grew. Princess Vajiri, the king's daughter, also lent her support to these classes. One full moon day, she asked the children to bring flowers to offer to the Buddha. The children arrived with flowers picked from their own gardens and from fields along the way to the monastery. Princess Vajiri brought an armful of lotus flowers she had gathered from the palace's lotus pool. When she and the children went to find the Buddha in his hut, they learned he was in the Dharma hall preparing to give a discourse to both bhikkhus and laypersons. The princess led the children quietly into the hall. All the adults moved to make a pathway for the children. They placed their flowers on the small table in front of the Buddha and then bowed. The Buddha smiled and bowed in return. He invited the children to sit right in front of him. The Buddha's Dharma talk that day was most special. He waited for the children to be seated quietly, and then he slowly stood up. He picked up one of the lotus flowers and held it up before the community. He did not say anything. Everyone sat perfectly still. The Buddha continued to hold up the flower without saying anything for a long time. People were perplexed and wondered what he meant by doing that. Then the Buddha looked out over the community and smiled. He said, "I have the eyes of true Dharma, the treasure of wondrous insight, and I have just transmitted it to Mahakasapa." Everyone turned to look at Venerable Kasapa and saw that he was smiling. His eyes had not wavered from the Buddha and the lotus he held. When the people looked back at the Buddha, they saw that he too was looking at the lotus and smiling. Though Svasti felt perplexed, he knew that the most important thing was to maintain mindfulness. He began to observe his breath as he looked at the Buddha. The white lotus in the Buddha's hand had newly blossomed. The Buddha held it in a most gentle, noble gesture. His thumb and forefinger held the stem of the flower, which trailed the shape of his hand. His hand was as beautiful as the lotus itself, pure and wondrous. Suddenly, Svasti truly saw the pure and noble beauty of the flower. There was nothing to think about. Quite naturally, a smile arose on his face. The Buddha began to speak, "Friends, this flower is a wondrous reality. As I hold the flower before you, you all have a chance to experience it. Making contact with a flower is to make contact with a wondrous reality. It is making contact with life itself." Mahakasapa smiled before anyone else because he was able to make contact with the flower. As long as obstacles remain in your minds, you will not be able to make contact with the flower. Some of you asked yourselves, "Why is Gautama holding that flower up? What is the meaning of his gesture?" If your minds are occupied with such thoughts, you cannot truly experience the flower. Friends, being lost in thoughts is one of the things that prevents us from making true contact with life. If you are ruled by worry, frustration, anxiety, anger, or jealousy, you will lose the chance to make real contact with all the wonders of life. Friends, the lotus in my hand is only real to those of you who dwell mindfully in the present moment. If you do not return to the present moment, the flower does not truly exist. There are people who can pass through a forest of sandalwood trees without ever really seeing one tree. Life is filled with suffering, but it also contains many wonders. Be aware in order to see both the suffering and the wonders in life. Being in touch with suffering does not mean to become lost in it. Being in touch with the wonders of life does not mean to lose ourselves in them either. Being in touch is to truly encounter life, to see it deeply. If we directly encounter life, we will understand its interdependent and impermanent nature. Thanks to that, we will no longer lose ourselves in desire, anger, and craving. We will dwell in freedom and liberation. Svasti felt happy. He was glad he had smiled and understood before the Buddha spoke. Venerable Mahakasapa had smiled first. He was one of Svasti's teachers and a senior disciple who had traveled far on the path. Svasti knew he could not compare himself to Mahakasapa and the other elders like Sariputta, Moggallana, and Asaji. After all, he was still only 24 years old. Chapter 52. Fields of Merit. The following year, Svasti spent the retreat season at Nigrodha Monastery in Kapilavatthu. The Buddha had returned to his homeland prior to the retreat after hearing about the conflict and unrest between the kingdoms of Sakya and Koliya. Koliya was his mother's native land. Princess Yasodhara was also from Koliya. The two kingdoms were separated by the Rohini River. In fact, the dispute concerned the rights to the river's water. Because of a drought, neither kingdom had enough water to irrigate its fields. Both kingdoms wanted to build a dam in the Rohini in order to have what little water there was. At first, the conflict began as no more than angry words hurled back and forth across the river by farmers. But soon, passions escalated, and the farmers began to throw rocks at each other. Police were sent in to protect citizens, and finally, soldiers were lined up on either side of the river. It looked as if the conflict could erupt into a war at any moment. The Buddha wanted, first of all, to understand the causes of the dispute. He asked the Sakya generals by the river, and they accused the citizens of Koliya of threatening the lives and property of Sakya citizens. Then he asked the generals on the Koliya side, and they accused the Sakya citizens of threatening the lives and properties of the citizens of Koliya. Only when the Buddha spoke directly to the local farmers did he learn that the real source of the conflict was the lack of water. Thanks to his close ties with both the Sakya and Koliya dynasties, the Buddha was able to bring about a meeting between King Mahanama and King Supabuddha. He asked them to negotiate a quick solution to the crisis, because both sides would lose in a war, whether the loss was greater or smaller. He said, "Your Majesties, which is more precious, water or human lives?" The kings agreed that human lives were infinitely more precious. The Buddha said, "Your Majesties, the need for adequate irrigation water has caused this conflict. If pride and anger had not flared up, this conflict could have been easily resolved. There is no need for war. Examine your hearts. Do not waste the blood of your people because of pride and anger. Once pride and anger are released, the tensions that lead to war will disappear. Sit down and negotiate how the river water can be shared equally with both sides in this time of drought. Both sides must be assured of an equal amount of water." Thanks to the Buddha's counsel, the two sides quickly reached an agreement. Warm and cordial relations were re-established. King Mahanama asked the Buddha to remain and spend the retreat season in Sakya. It was the 15th retreat season he attained enlightenment. After the retreat, the Buddha returned south. He spent the 16th retreat season in Alavi, the 17th at Bamboo Forest, the 18th in Koliya, and the 19th in Rajagaha. Whenever he stayed in Rajagaha, the Buddha preferred dwelling on Jigakuta Mountain. Because the peak resembled a vulture, it was called Vulture Peak. Kim Bimbisara frequently visited the Buddha on Vulture Peak for Dharma instruction. He even had steps built into the mountainside that led all the way to the Buddha's hut. He also had small bridges built over the tumbling waterfalls and springs. He liked to leave his carriage at the foot of the mountain and climb up the stone steps. Close by the Buddha's hut was a rock as large as several houses, and a clear stream where he could wash his robes and dry them on a smooth rock. The Buddha's hut was constructed of stones gathered on the mountain. The view from the Buddha's hut was magnificent. He especially enjoyed watching the sunsets. Senior disciples such as Sariputta, Uruvelakasapa, Moggallana, Upali, Devadatta, and Ananda also had huts on Vulture Peak. The Buddha's Sangha now had 18 practice centers in and near Rajagaha. In addition to Bamboo Forest, Vinuvana, and Vulture Peak, some of the centers were Vaibharavana, Sarpasundika Pragbara, Saptaparnaguha, and Indra Shailaguha. The last two were located in enormous caves. Jivaka, the son of Ambapali and King Bimbisara, was now a physician, and he lived in a hut close by Vulture Peak, having become one of the Buddha's closest lay disciples. He was already renowned for his skill in curing fatal diseases. He served as King Bimbisara's personal physician. Jivaka looked after the health of the Buddha and bhikkhus on Vulture Peak and at Bamboo Forest. Every winter, he arranged for friends to bring extra robes for the bhikkhus to use as blankets for warmth at night. He offered a robe to the Buddha himself. Jivaka was interested in the prevention of diseases as well as their cure. He suggested a number of basic sanitary measures to the bhikkhus. He suggested that before drinking the water taken from ponds and lakes, it should be boiled, that the bhikkhus wash their robes at least once every 7 days, and that more toilets be provided on the monastery grounds. He cautioned the bhikkhus not to eat food left over from the night before. The Buddha accepted all of Jivaka's suggestions. Robe offering became a very popular practice among the lay people. One day, the Buddha spotted a bhikkhu returning to the monastery with a pile of robes heaped on his shoulder. The Buddha asked him, "How many robes do you have there?" The bhikkhu answered, "Lord, I have 8. Do you think you need that many?" "No, Lord, I do not. I only accepted them because the people offered them to me." "How many robes do you think a bhikkhu actually needs?" "Lord, according to my way of thinking, 3 robes are adequate. 3 are plenty to keep warm on cold nights." "I share your thoughts. I find 3 robes sufficient on cold nights. From now on, let us announce that each bhikkhu will own only 1 begging bowl and no more than 3 robes. If more than that are offered, the bhikkhu will decline them." The bhikkhu bowed to the Buddha and then walked back to his own hut. One day, while standing on a high hill, the Buddha looked out over the fields of rice paddies. He turned to Ananda and said, "Ananda, how beautiful are the golden patches of rice that stretch to the horizon. Wouldn't it be nice to sew our robes in the same checkered pattern?" Ananda said, "Lord, it is a wonderful idea. Sewing bhikkhus' robes in the same pattern as rice fields would be lovely. You have said that a bhikkhu who practices the way is like a fertile field in which seeds of virtue and merit have been sown to benefit both the present and future generations. When one makes offerings to such a bhikkhu, or studies and practices with him, it is like sowing seeds of virtue and merit. I will tell the rest of the community to sow future robes in the pattern of rice fields. We can call our robes fields of merit." The Buddha smiled his approval. The following year, the Buddha returned to Jetavana for the retreat season. After Sudatta came to Rajagaha and reminded the Buddha how long it had been since he had spent a retreat at Jetavana. It was the 20th retreat season since the Buddha attained enlightenment. The Buddha was now 55 years old. King Pasenadi rejoiced when he heard of the Buddha's return, and he visited the Buddha with all the royal family, including his second wife, Vrishabhakshatriya, and their 2 children, Prince Vidudaba and Princess Vajna. His second wife was of the Sakya clan. After King Pasenadi had become the Buddha's disciple years ago, he sent a delegation to Sakya to request the hand of a Sakya princess. King Mahanama sent his own daughter, the beautiful Vrishabhakshatriya. King Pasenadi did not miss a single Dharma talk given by the Buddha during the retreat season. More and more people came to hear the Buddha teach. One of the most supportive new lay disciples was Lady Visakha, who offered the bhikkhus her large and verdant forest east of Savatthi. Though it was somewhat smaller in size, it was no less beautiful than Jetavana. With the help of many of her friends, Lady Visakha had a meditation hall, dharma hall, and huts built in the forest. At Venerable Sariputta's suggestion, they named this new monastery Eastern Park, or Purvarama. The dharma hall located in the center of the forest was named Visakha Hall. Lady Visakha was born in the city of Bhatia in the kingdom of Anga. She was the daughter of an extremely wealthy man named Dhananjaya. Her husband, a wealthy man from Savatthi, and her son had been disciples of Nigantha Nataputta, and neither had felt drawn to the Buddha initially. However, inspired by Lady Visakha's devotion to the Dharma, they slowly began to be interested and finally asked to become lay disciples. Lady Visakha and her friend Lady Supiya visited the Buddha's monastery frequently, offering medicine, robes, and towels to any bhikkhus and bhikkhunis who needed them. She also pledged to support Sister Mahapajapati's efforts in building a spiritual center for the bhikkhunis along the right bank of the Ganga. Lady Visakha was an ardent supporter of the nuns, both in material and spiritual matters. Her compassionate wisdom was helpful on more than one occasion in resolving minor conflicts among the bhikkhunis. Two important decisions were made during a Dharma meeting that took place in Visakha's hall. The first was that Ananda should be the Buddha's permanent assistant. The second one was that the Buddha should return every year to Savatthi for the rainy retreat season. The first suggestion was proposed by Sariputta, who said, "Brother Ananda has the finest memory among us. No one else possesses his uncanny ability to remember every word the Buddha speaks. He can repeat the Buddha's discourses without leaving out one word. If Ananda serves as the Buddha's attendant, he will be present to hear all that the Buddha teaches, whether it is a Dharma talk delivered to a large crowd or a private conversation with a lay disciple. The Buddha's teaching is infinitely precious. We should make every effort to preserve and protect it. Through our negligence in the past 20 years, we have lost many things the Buddha has uttered. Brother Ananda, on behalf of all of us, and on behalf of future generations, please accept the task of being the Buddha's attendant." All the bhikkhus voiced their support for Venerable Sariputta's proposal. Venerable Ananda, however, expressed reluctance. He said, "I see a number of problems. To begin with, it is not certain that the Buddha will agree to have me as his attendant. The Buddha has always been careful not to treat members of the Sakya clan with special favors. He is even strict and reserved with Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati, his own stepmother. Rahula has never slept in the Buddha's hut or shared a private meal with him. The Buddha has never afforded me any special privileges. I am afraid that if I am chosen as his attendant, some brothers will accuse me of using my position to attain special favors. Other brothers may accuse me of pointing out their faults to the Buddha, should the Buddha happen to correct them." Ananda looked at Sariputta and then continued, "The Buddha has especially high regard for our brother Sariputta, the most talented and intelligent brother among us. Sariputta has been instrumental in teaching and organizing the Sangha, and it is only natural that the Buddha places a great deal of trust in him. Even so, Sariputta has earned the jealousy of many brothers. Although the Buddha always confers with several people before making a major decision, some brothers complain that Sariputta makes the decisions as if the Buddha were incapable of making his own decisions. These accusations are ridiculous, but it is because of this sort of misunderstanding that I wish to decline becoming the Buddha's attendant." Venerable Sariputta smiled. "I am not afraid of another brother's jealousy that may arise from his temporary misunderstanding. I believe that each of us should do what we see to be correct and beneficial, regardless of what others may say. Ananda, we know that you are careful and attentive in all your actions. Please accept this position. If you don't, the Dharma will suffer in this generation and for generations to come." Venerable Ananda sat silently. After a long hesitation, he finally said, "I will accept this position if the Buddha will agree to these requests. First, the Buddha will never give me any of his own robes. Second, the Buddha will not share his food offerings with me. Third, the Buddha will not allow me to dwell in the same hut with him. Fourth, The Buddha will not ask me to accompany him to a lay disciple's home for a meal. Fifth, if I am invited to a lay disciple's home for a meal, the Buddha can go as well. Sixth, the Buddha will allow me to use my discretion for refusing people who come to request an audience with him. Seventh, the Buddha will let me ask him to repeat things he says that I have not fully grasped. And eighth, the Buddha will repeat the essence of any Dharma talk he gives that I have been unable to attend. Venerable Upali stood to speak. Ananda's conditions seem most reasonable. I am sure the Buddha will agree to them. However, I cannot agree with the fourth request. If our brother Ananda does not accompany the Buddha to the homes of lay disciples, how will he be able to record things the Buddha says to laymen and women, which may be of benefit to future generations and all of us? I suggest that whenever the Buddha is invited for a meal at a layperson's home, he take another bhikkhu in addition to Ananda. That way, no one can accuse Ananda of receiving special favors. Ananda said, Brother, I do not think that is such a good suggestion. What if the lay disciple only has the means to offer food to two bhikkhus? Upali retorted, Then the Buddha and you two bhikkhus will have to be content eating less. The rest of the bhikkhus burst into hearty laughter. They knew the problems of finding the best attendant for the Buddha had been solved. They next considered the proposal that the Buddha hold every rainy season retreat in Savatthi. Savatthi was a good location because Jetavana, Eastern Park, and the Bhikkhunis convent were all nearby. It would serve well as the Sangha's main center. With the Buddha in the same location every year, many people could plan to attend the retreat and receive the Buddha's teaching directly. Lay patrons such as Anattapindika and Lady Visakha had already pledged to provide food, medicine, robes, and lodging for any bhikkhus and bhikkhunis traveling to Savatthi for the retreat season. The bhikkhus concluded their meeting by agreeing to hold every rainy retreat in Savatthi, and they went directly to the Buddha's hut to present their ideas. The Buddha happily accepted both proposals. Chapter 53, Dwelling in the Present Moment. In the spring of the following year, the Buddha delivered the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutra on the four establishments of mindfulness, to a gathering of more than 300 bhikkhus in Kamasadama, which was the capital of Kuru. This was a sutra fundamental for the practice of meditation. The Buddha referred to it as the path that could help every person attain peace of body and mind, overcome all sorrows and lamentations, destroy suffering and grief, and attain highest understanding and total emancipation. Later, Venerable Sariputta told the community that this was one of the most important sutras the Buddha had ever given. He encouraged every bhikkhu and bhikkhuni to study, memorize, and practice it. Venerable Ananda repeated every word of the sutra later that night. Sati means to dwell in mindfulness. That is, the practitioner remains aware of everything taking place in his body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind, the four establishments of mindfulness or awareness. First, the practitioner observes his body, his breath, the four bodily postures of walking, standing, lying, and sitting. Bodily actions such as going forward and backward, looking, putting on robes, eating, drinking, using the toilet, speaking, and washing robes. The parts of the body such as hair, teeth, sinews, bones, internal organs, marrow, intestines, saliva, and sweat. The elements which compose the body such as water, air, and heat. And the stages of the body's decay from the time it dies to when the bones turn to dust. While observing the body, the practitioner is aware of all details concerning the body. For example, while breathing in, the practitioner knows he is breathing in. Breathing out, he knows he is breathing out. Breathing in and making his whole body calm and at peace, the practitioner knows he is breathing in and making his whole body calm and at peace. Walking, the practitioner knows he is walking. Sitting, the practitioner knows he is sitting. Performing movements such as putting on robes or drinking water, the practitioner knows he is putting on robes or drinking water. The contemplation of the body is not realized only during the moments of sitting meditation, but throughout the entire day, including the moments one is begging, eating, and washing one's bowl. In the contemplation of feelings, the practitioner contemplates feelings as they arise, develop, and fade, feelings that are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Feelings can have as their source either the body or the mind. When he feels pain from a toothache, the practitioner is aware that he feels pain from a toothache. When he is happy because he has received praise, the practitioner is aware that he is happy because he has received praise. The practitioner looks deeply in order to calm and quiet every feeling, in order to clearly see the sources that give rise to feelings. The contemplation of feelings does not take place only during the moments of sitting meditation. It is practiced throughout the day. In the contemplation of mind, the practitioner contemplates the presence of his mental states. Cravings, he knows he is craving. Not craving, he knows he is not craving. Angry or drowsy, he knows he is angry or drowsy. Not angry or drowsy, he knows he is not angry or drowsy. Centered or distracted, he knows he is centered or distracted. Whether he is open-minded, close-minded, blocked, concentrated, or enlightened, the practitioner knows at once. And if he is not experiencing any of those states, the practitioner also knows at once. The practitioner recognizes and is aware of every mental state that arises within him in the present moment. In the contemplation of the objects of mind, the practitioner contemplates the five hindrances to liberation: sense desire, ill will, drowsiness, agitation, and doubt, whenever they are present. The five skandhas, which comprise a person, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. The six sense organs and the six sense objects. The seven factors of awakening: full attention, investigating dharmas, energy, joy, ease, concentration, and letting go. And the Four Noble Truths: the existence of suffering, the causes of suffering, liberation from suffering, and the path that leads to liberation from suffering. These are all objects of the mind, and they contain all dharmas. The Buddha carefully explained each of the four establishments. He said that whoever practices these four establishments for 7 years would attain emancipation. He added that anyone who practiced them for 7 months could also attain emancipation. He said that even after practicing these four contemplations for 7 days, one could attain emancipation. During a Dharma discussion, Venerable Asaji reminded the community that this was not the first time the Buddha had taught the four establishments of mindfulness. He had, in fact, spoken about them on several occasions. But this was the first time he had compiled all of his previous teaching on the subject in so complete and thorough a way. Asaji agreed with Sariputta that this sutra should be memorized, recited, and practiced by every bhikkhu and bhikkhuni. When the Buddha returned to Jetavana toward the end of spring that year, he met and transformed a notorious murderer named Angulimala. One morning when the Buddha entered Savatthi, it seemed like a ghost town. All the doors were bolted shut. No one was on the streets. The Buddha stood in front of a home where he normally received food offerings. The door opened a crack, and seeing it was the Buddha, the owner hastily ran out and invited him to enter. Once inside, the owner latched the door and invited the Buddha to sit. He suggested the Buddha remain to eat his meal inside the house. He said, "Lord, it is very dangerous to go outdoors today. The murderer Angulimala has been seen in these parts. They say he has killed many people in other cities. Every time he kills someone, he cuts off one of their fingers and adds it to a string he wears around his neck. They say that once he has killed 100 people and has a talisman of 100 fingers hanging around his neck, he will gain even more terrible evil powers. It is strange. He never steals anything from the people he murders. King Pasenadi has organized a brigade of soldiers and police to hunt him down." The Buddha asked, "Why must the king enlist the aid of an entire brigade of soldiers to hunt down just one man?" "Respected Gautama, Angulimala is very dangerous. He possesses phenomenal fighting skills. Once he overcame 40 men who surrounded him on a street. He killed most of them. The survivors had to flee for their lives. Angulimala is said to hide out in Jalini Forest. No one dares pass by there anymore. Not long ago, 20 armed police entered the forest to try to capture him. Only 2 came out alive. Now that Angulimala has been spotted in the city, no one dares go out to work or shop." The Buddha thanked the man for telling him about Angulimala, and then stood up to take his leave. The man implored the Buddha to remain safely inside, but the Buddha refused. He said that he could only preserve the trust of the people by continuing to do his begging as usual. As the Buddha walked slowly and mindfully down the street, he suddenly heard the sound of steps running behind him in the distance. He knew it was Angulimala, but he felt no fear. He continued to take slow steps, aware of everything taking place within and outside of himself. Angulimala shouted, "Stop, monk, stop!" The Buddha continued taking slow, stable steps. He knew from the sound of Angulimala's footsteps that he had slowed down to a brisk walk and was not far behind. Although the Buddha was now 56 years old, his sight and hearing were keener than ever. He held nothing but his begging bowl. He smiled as he recollected how quick and agile he had been in martial arts as a young prince. The other young men were never able to deliver him a blow. The Buddha knew that Angulimala was very close, surely carrying a weapon. The Buddha continued to walk with ease. When Angulimala caught up to the Buddha, he walked alongside him and said, "I told you to stop, monk. Why don't you stop?" The Buddha continued to walk as he said, "Angulimala, I stopped a long time ago. It is you who have not stopped." Angulimala was startled by the Buddha's unusual reply. He blocked the Buddha's path, forcing the Buddha to stop. The Buddha looked into Angulimala's eyes. Again, Angulimala was startled. The Buddha's eyes shone like two stars. Angulimala had never encountered someone who radiated such serenity and ease. Everyone else always ran away from him in terror. Why didn't this monk show any fear? The Buddha was looking at him as if he were a friend or brother. The Buddha had said Angulimala's name, so it was clear that he knew who Angulimala was. Surely he knew about his treacherous deeds. How could he remain so calm and relaxed when faced with a murderer? Suddenly, Angulimala felt he could no longer bear the Buddha's kind and gentle gaze. He said, "Monk, you said you stopped a long time ago, but you were still walking. You said I was the one who has not stopped. What did you mean by that?" The Buddha replied, "Angulimala, I stopped committing acts that cause suffering to other living beings a long time ago. I have learned to protect life, the lives of all beings, not just humans. Angulimala, all living beings want to live. All fear death. We must nurture a heart of compassion and protect the lives of all beings. Human beings do not love each other. Why should I love other people? Humans are cruel and deceptive. I will not rest until I have killed them all." The Buddha spoke gently. "Angulimala, I know you have suffered deeply at the hands of other humans. Sometimes humans can be most cruel. Such cruelty is the result of ignorance, hatred, desire, and jealousy. But humans can also be understanding and compassionate. Have you ever met a bhikkhu before? Bhikkhus vow to protect the lives of all other beings. They vow to overcome desire, hatred, and ignorance. There are many people, not just bhikkhus, whose lives are based on understanding and love. Angulimala, there may be cruel people in this world, but there are also many kind people. Do not be blinded. My path can transform cruelty into kindness. Hatred is the path you are on now. You should stop. Choose the path of forgiveness, understanding, and love instead." Angulimala was moved by the monk's words. Yet his mind was thrown into confusion as well, and suddenly he felt as if he had been cut open and salt thrown on the open wound. He could see that the Buddha spoke from love. There was no hatred in the Buddha, no aversion. The monk looked at Angulimala as if he considered him a whole person worthy of respect. Could this monk be the very Gautama he had heard people praise, the one they called the Buddha? Angulimala asked, "Are you the monk Gautama?" The Buddha nodded. Angulimala said, "It is a great pity I did not meet you sooner. I have gone too far already on my path of destruction. It is no longer possible to turn back." The Buddha said, "No, Angulimala, it is never too late to do a good act. What good act could I possibly do? Stop traveling the road of hatred and violence. That would be the greatest act of all. Angulimala, though the sea of suffering is immense, look back and you will see the shore. Gautama, even if I wanted to, I could not turn back now. No one would let me live in peace after all I have done." The Buddha grasped Angulimala's hand and said, "Angulimala, I will protect you if you vow to abandon your mind of hatred and devote yourself to the study and practice of the way. Take the vow to begin anew and serve others. It is easy to see you are a man of intelligence. I have no doubt you could succeed on the path of realization. Angulimala knelt before the Buddha. He removed the sword strapped to his back, placed it on the earth, and prostrated himself at the Buddha's feet. He covered his face in his hands and began to sob. After a long time, he looked up and said, I vow to abandon my evil ways. I will follow you and learn compassion from you. I beg you to accept me as your disciple. At that moment, Venerables Sariputta, Ananda, Upali, Kimbila, and several other bhikkhus arrived on the scene. They surrounded the Buddha and Angulimala. Seeing the Buddha safe and Angulimala preparing to take the refuges, their hearts rejoiced. The Buddha asked Ananda to give him an extra set of robes. He told Sariputta to ask the next house if they could borrow a razor for Upali to shave Angulimala's head. Angulimala was ordained right then and there. He knelt down, recited the three refuges, and was given the precepts by Upali. Afterward, they returned to Jetavana together. Over the next 10 days, Upali and Sariputta taught Angulimala about the practice of the precepts, the practice of meditation, and the way of begging. Angulimala made a greater effort than any other bhikkhu before him. Even the Buddha was astonished at his transformation when he visited Angulimala 2 weeks after his ordination. Angulimala radiated serenity and stability, and so rare a gentleness that the other bhikkhus called him Ahimsaka, which means non-violent one. It had, in fact, been his name at birth. Svasti found it a most fitting name for him, for outside of the Buddha, there was no other bhikkhu whose gaze was more filled with kindness. One morning, the Buddha entered Savati to beg, accompanied by 50 other bhikkhus, including Bhikkhu Ahimsaka. As they reached the city gates, they met King Pasenadi mounted on a steed leading a battalion of soldiers. The king and his generals were dressed in full fighting gear. When the king saw the Buddha, he dismounted and bowed. The Buddha asked, Majesty, has something happened? Has another kingdom invaded your borders? The king replied, Lord, no one has invaded Kosala. I have gathered these soldiers to capture the murderer Angulimala. He is extremely dangerous. No one has yet been able to bring him to justice. He was seen in the city just 2 weeks ago. My people are still living in constant fear. The Buddha asked, Are you sure Angulimala is really that dangerous? The king said, Lord, Angulimala is a danger to every man, woman, and child. I cannot rest until he is found and killed. The Buddha asked, If Angulimala repented his ways and vowed never to kill again, if he took the vows of a bhikkhu and respected all living beings, would you still need to capture and kill him? Lord, if Angulimala became your disciple and followed the precept against killing, if he lived the pure and harmless life of a bhikkhu, my happiness would know no bounds. Not only would I spare his life and grant him freedom, I would offer him robes, food, and medicine. But I hardly think such a thing will come to pass. The Buddha pointed to Ahimsaka standing behind him and said, Your Majesty, this monk is none other than Angulimala. He has taken the precepts of a bhikkhu. He has become a new man in these past 2 weeks. King Pasenadi was horrified when he realized he was standing so close to the notorious killer. The Buddha said, There is no need to fear him, Your Majesty. Bhikkhu Angulimala is gentler than a handful of earth. We call him Ahimsaka now. The king stared long and hard at Ahimsaka and then bowed to him. He asked, Respected monk, what family were you born into? What was your father's name? Your Majesty, my father's name was Gaga. My mother was Mantani. Bhikkhu Gaga Mantaniputta, allow me to offer you robes, food, and medicine. Ahimsaka answered, Thank you, Your Majesty, but I have 3 robes already. I receive my food each day by begging, and I have no need for medicine at present. Please accept my heartfelt gratitude for your offer. The king bowed again to the new bhikkhu and then turned to the Buddha. Enlightened Master, your virtue is truly wondrous. You bring peace and well-being to situations no one else can. What others fail to resolve by force and violence, you resolve by your great virtue. Let me express my profound gratitude. The king departed after informing his generals they could disband the troops and everyone could return to their regular duties. Chapter 54. Dwell in Mindfulness. News about Angulimala's ordination spread quickly throughout the city. Everyone sighed with relief. Even neighboring kingdoms soon learned of the murderer's transformation, and the people held the Buddha and his Sangha in ever greater esteem. The Sangha continued to attract many bright and able young men who abandoned other sects to follow the teaching of the Buddha. The story of how lay disciple Upali left the Niigata sect became a heated topic of conversation among religious circles in Magadha and Kosala. Upali was a wealthy and talented young man who lived in northern Magadha. He was one of the chief patrons of the Niigata sect, led by a teacher named Nataputta. The ascetics of Niigata lived most frugally, shunning even clothes, and they were highly regarded by the people. That spring, the Buddha was dwelling in Pavarika Mango Grove in Nalanda. He received a visit from one of Nataputta's senior students, the ascetic Digatapasi, who stopped by one day after begging in Nalanda. The Buddha learned from Tapasi that the followers of Niigata did not speak of karma, karmani, but only of sins, dandani. Tapasi explained that there were three kinds of sin: sins committed by the body, sins caused by wrong speech, and sinful thoughts. When the Buddha asked him which form of sin was the most serious, the ascetic answered, "Sins committed by the body are the most serious." The Buddha told him that according to the way of awakening, unwholesome thought was considered more serious because the mind was more fundamental. Ascetic Tapasi heard the Buddha repeat this three times so he could recant it later. He then took his leave and returned to Nataputta, who burst out laughing when Tapasi told him what the Buddha had said. Nataputta said, "That monk Gautama has made a grave error. Sinful thought and speech are not the greatest sins. Sins committed by the body are the most serious and have the longest-lasting consequences. Ascetic Tapasi, you have grasped the essentials of my teaching." A number of other disciples were present during this exchange, including the merchant Upali, who was visiting with several of his friends from Balaka. Upali expressed an interest in visiting the Buddha himself to challenge the Buddha's view on this matter. Nataputta encouraged Upali to go, but Tapasi expressed reservations. He was worried that the Buddha might be able to convince Upali and perhaps even convert him. Nataputta had great faith in Upali and said, "There is no need to fear that Upali will leave us to become a disciple of Gautama's. Who can say, perhaps Gautama will become a disciple of Upali's?" Tapasi still tried to discourage Upali from going, but Upali's mind was set. When Upali met the Buddha, he was immediately impressed by the Buddha's lively and stimulating way of speaking. By using seven examples, the Buddha showed Upali why unwholesome thought was more fundamental than unwholesome speech or action. The Buddha knew that disciples of the Niigata sect observed the precept not to kill. He knew how careful they were not to step on insects, for fear they would crush them, and he praised them for this. Then he asked Upali, "If you do not intentionally step on an insect, but do so accidentally, have you committed a sin?" Upali responded, "Master Nataputta says that if you did not intend to kill, you have not committed a sin." The Buddha smiled and said, "Then Master Nataputta agrees that thought is what is fundamental. How then can he maintain that sinful action is more serious?" Upali was impressed with the Buddha's clarity and wisdom. He later confessed to the Buddha that the first example was sufficiently convincing, and he had only pressed the Buddha to provide more examples in order to have a chance to listen to more of the Buddha's teaching. When the Buddha finished explaining the seventh example, Upali prostrated before him and asked to be accepted as a disciple. The Buddha said, "Upali, you should consider such a request carefully. A man of your intelligence and stature should not make a hasty decision. Reflect until you are sure." The Buddha's words made Upali respect him all the more. He could see that the Buddha was not interested in converting others in order to add to his own prestige. No other spiritual teacher had ever told Upali to reflect carefully before supporting his community. Upali answered, "Lord, I have reflected enough. Please allow me to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I am most grateful and happy to have discovered the true and correct path." The Buddha said, "Disciple Upali, you have long been a major patron of the Niigata sect. Even though you take refuge with me, please do not cease making offerings to your former sect." Upali said, "Lord, you are truly noble. You are open and generous, unlike any teacher I have ever known." When Tapasi delivered the news to Nataputta that Upali had become one of the Buddha's disciples, Nataputta couldn't believe it. He went with Tapasi to Upali's house, where Upali confirmed the truth. More and more people throughout the kingdoms of Mogadha and Kosala accepted the path of awakening. Many bhikkhus announced this happy news to the Buddha when they visited him in Savatthi. The Buddha told them, "Whether the increase in numbers of people accepting the path as their own is good news or not depends on how diligent the bhikkhus are in their practice. We should not cling to concepts of success or failure. We should look at both fortune and misfortune with equanimity." One morning, as the Buddha and the bhikkhus prepared to leave the monastery to go begging, several police entered Jetavana with orders to search for the body of a woman. The bhikkhus were dismayed, not understanding why the police expected to find a woman's corpse on the monastery grounds. Venerable Bhadiya asked who the woman was, and was told she was a young woman named Sundari, who belonged to a large religious sect in Savatthi. The bhikkhus recognized the name as belonging to an attractive young woman who in recent months had attended several Dharma talks at the monastery. The bhikkhus told the police there was no chance her body would be found at Jetavana, but the police insisted on looking anyway. To everyone's surprise, they found the body buried in a shallow grave not too distant from the Buddha's hut. No one could understand how she had died and why she'd been buried there. After the police departed with the body, the Buddha told the bhikkhus to go out begging as usual. "Dwell in mindfulness," he told them. Later that same day, members of Sundari's sect carried her body throughout the city, wailing in loud voices. They stopped at intervals and cried out to the people, "This is the body of Sundari. Her broken body was discovered in a shallow grave at Jetavana Monastery. Those monks who claim to come from the noble line of Sakya, who claim to live chaste, pure lives, they raped Sundari, killed her, and then tried to hide her body. Their talk of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity is nothing but a sham. See for yourselves." The citizens of Savatthi were disturbed. Even some of the most solid disciples of the Buddha felt their faith waver. Others were convinced that the whole affair had been orchestrated to harm the Buddha's reputation, and they suffered deeply. Other spiritual sects that felt threatened by the Buddha seized the opportunity to openly condemn and malign the Sangha. The bhikkhus were interrogated and heckled wherever they went. They did their best to maintain their serenity and to dwell in mindfulness, but it was difficult, especially for bhikkhus still new to the practice. Many young bhikkhus felt shamed and no longer wanted to beg in the city. The Buddha gathered the bhikkhus together one afternoon and spoke to them. "Unjust accusations can occur anywhere at any time. There is no need for you to feel ashamed. The only cause for shame would be if you ceased your efforts to live your pure life of practice. This false accusation will spread, and then it will pass away. Tomorrow, when you go begging, if anyone asks you about this affair, simply answer, 'Whoever is responsible will reap the fruits.'" The bhikkhus were much comforted by the Buddha's words. Meanwhile, Lady Visakha, who was greatly disturbed over the affair, went to see Sudatta. Together, they discussed the matter at some length. They agreed to secretly hire someone to make an investigation in order to uncover the real culprits. They shared their plan with Prince Jeta, who agreed to help them. Within 7 days, the secret investigator discovered who the actual killers were. The two men responsible became drunk and began to argue over their spoils. In their angry, drunken state, they let the truth slip out. Royal police were summoned and the men were arrested. They made a confession and told the police how they were hired by the leaders of Sundari's sect to kill her and bury her near the Buddha's hut. King Pasenadi visited Jetavana at once to share the news that the killers had been found. He expressed his unwavering faith in the Sangha and his joy that the truth would now be known to all the people. The Buddha asked the king to forgive those responsible for the crime. He also said that similar crimes could happen again unless people learned to overcome their hatred and jealousy. The people of Savatthi once again regarded the bhikkhus with great admiration and respect. Chapter 55. Appearance of the Morning Star. One day, the Buddha and Ananda visited a small monastery located just outside the city. They arrived when most of the bhikkhus were out begging. As they strolled around the monastery grounds, they suddenly heard a pitiful groan coming from one of the huts. The Buddha entered the hut and found an emaciated bhikkhu curled up in one corner. A terrible stench filled the air. The Buddha knelt beside him and asked, "Brother, are you ill?" The bhikkhu answered, "Lord, I have dysentery. Isn't anyone looking after you? Lord, the other brothers have gone out begging. There is no one here but me. When I first fell ill, several of the brothers did try to care for me. But when I saw I was of no use to anyone, I told them not to bother with me anymore." The Buddha told Ananda, "Go fetch some water. We will bathe our brother." Ananda brought a bucket of water and helped the Buddha bathe the sick bhikkhu. They changed his robe and lifted him back onto his bed. The Buddha and Ananda then scrubbed the floor and washed the bhikkhu's soiled robes. They were hanging the robes out to dry when the other bhikkhus returned. Venerable Ananda asked them to boil some water and prepare medicine for their brother. The community invited the Buddha and Ananda to eat with them. After the meal, the Buddha asked them, "From what illness is the bhikkhu in that hut suffering?" "Lord Buddha, he has dysentery." "Has anyone been caring for him?" "Lord Buddha, at first we tried to look after him, but then he asked us not to." "Bhikkhus, when we leave our homes to follow the way, we leave parents and family behind. If we don't look after each other when we are sick, who will? We must care for one another. Whether the ill person is a teacher, a student, or a friend, we must tend to him until he has regained his health. Bhikkhus, if I were sick, would you tend to my needs?" "Yes, certainly, Lord Buddha." "Then you must tend to the needs of any bhikkhu who falls ill. Caring for any bhikkhu is the same as caring for the Buddha." The bhikkhus joined their palms and bowed. The next summer, the Buddha stayed at Eastern Park in Savatthi, at the same time that Bhikkhuni Mahapajapati, a large community of nuns in Savatthi. She was assisted by Bhikkhimikkhema, who once had become one of King Bimbisara's wives. She had become a disciple of the Buddha 20 years earlier. At that time, her profound natural insight was somewhat marred by her arrogance, but after receiving instruction from the Buddha, she learned humility. After only 4 years of practice as a lay disciple, she asked to be ordained. She was most diligent in her practice and was now an important teacher and leader among the nuns. Lady Visakha regularly visited her and the other bhikkhunis. One day she invited Sudatta, also known as Anathapindika, the philanthropist who had purchased the Jeta Grove for the Sangha, to accompany her. She introduced him to sisters Khema, Damadina, Upalavarma, and Patakara. Lady Visakha later told him that she knew them before they became nuns. Another day, Sudatta visited the Bhikkhuni center with a male friend, also named Visakha, who was a relative of Bhikkhuni Damadina, a well-known teacher among the nuns. The two men listened to Bhikkhuni Damadina give a Dharma talk on the five skandhas and the Noble Eightfold Path. Visakha was astonished by her profound grasp of subtle truths. When he returned to Jetavana, he told the Buddha everything Bhikkhuni Damadina had said. The Buddha replied, "If you asked me about the same subjects, I would have said the very same things as Sister Damadina. She has truly grasped the teaching of emancipation and enlightenment." The Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "Ananda, please remember Sister Damadina's discourse and repeat it to the entire community of monks. Her discourse is an important one." Bhikkhuni Badakapilani was also renowned for her grasp of the Dharma. Like Sister Damadina, she was often invited to travel to offer teaching. The story of Bhikkhuni Patakara was heart-wrenching. She was the only daughter of a wealthy family in Savatthi. Her parents were overly protective of her and never allowed her to leave the house. All day long she was required to stay inside. Thus she never had a chance to meet many people. When she reached an age suitable for marriage, she fell in love, without her parents' knowledge, with a young servant in their household. When her parents arranged for her to marry the son of another wealthy family, Patakara urged her secret lover to run away with her. Early on the morning she was to be married, she disguised herself as a servant girl and pretended to go outside to fetch water. As soon as she was outside, she met her lover and they fled to a distant village where they were married. 3 years later, Patakara became pregnant. When she neared her time, she asked her husband to take her to her parents' house to give birth there, as was the custom. Her husband was reluctant, but because she insisted, he agreed. But halfway there, Patakara went into labor and delivered a son. As there was no longer any need to return to her parents' home, they went back to their own village. 2 years later, Patakara was again with child. Again, she insisted her husband take her to her parents' house. This time, they met with tragedy. Along the way, a storm broke, just as she was going into labor. Her husband asked her to wait by the side of the road while he entered the forest to cut some branches to make a shelter. Patakara waited for a long time, but her husband did not return. In the middle of the night, surrounded by rain and wind, she gave birth to a second son. At dawn, she lifted her newborn son in one arm and held her other son's hand and entered the forest to look for her husband. She found him dead from a poisonous snake bite. She wept bitterly for a long time, and she stood up and headed with her two sons toward her old home in Savatthi. At last, she reached the river. The waters were swollen from the rain, making the water too deep for her first son to wade across. She told him to wait on the bank while she carried the baby safely to the other side first. She held the infant over her head as she walked through the deep waters. When she was halfway across, a mighty eagle swept down and grabbed the baby in its talons. She screamed at the bird to release her child, but it flew away. When her other son heard her cries, he thought she was calling him to join her. When Patakara turned around, she saw him stepping into the rushing waters. She shouted at him to wait, but it was too late. The strong current swept him away, and she was unable to save him. At last, Patakara crossed to the other shore and collapsed on the banks. When she came to, she stood up and walked for several days until she reached Savatthi. When she finally arrived, she learned that her parents' home had been destroyed in the storm and both her parents killed when a wall collapsed on them. Patakara had returned on the same day her parents' bodies were being cremated. Patakara collapsed by the side of the road. She no longer wanted to live. Some people took pity on her and took her to see the Buddha. He listened to her tell her story, and he told her in a gentle voice, "Patakara, you have suffered terribly. But life is not only suffering and misfortune. Be brave. Practice the way of enlightenment, and one day you will be able to smile even at your most painful sufferings. You will learn how to create new peace and joy in the present and for the future." Patakara bowed and asked to take the refuges. The Buddha entrusted her to Sister Mahapajapati's care. Soon afterward, Patakara was ordained as a bhikkhuni. She was deeply loved by Sister Mahapajapati and the other bhikkhunis. After several years of practice, she learned to smile again. One day, while washing her feet, she watched the streams of water disappear back into the earth, and she had sudden insight into the nature of impermanence. She held that image in her mind during her meditation for several days and nights, and one dawn, she broke through the problem of birth and death. Spontaneously, she wrote a poem. "The other day, while washing my feet, I watched the streams of water flow back into the heart of the earth. I asked, 'To where does the water return?' Contemplating in serene silence, mind and body held in mindfulness, I looked into the nature of the six sense objects with the spirit of a strong, quick horse. Staring at the oil lamp wick, I concentrated my mind. Time passed quickly. The oil lamp still shone. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. The light was instantly extinguished, submerging all in darkness. The flame was extinguished, but suddenly my soul was bright. My mind was released from all bondage as the morning star appeared." When Patakara presented her poem to Sister Mahapajapati, the abbess gave it her deepest praises. Sister Upalavana was another bhikkhuni who came to the Dharma after great suffering, thanks to the efforts of Venerable Moggallana. She was a woman of uncommon beauty, even with her head shaved. She was most diligent in her practice, and one of Abbess Pajapati's finest assistants. Venerable Moggallana met Sister Upalavana one day while he was walking past a city park. She was standing there, a flower of the night. She was known to men as Beautiful Lotus, Indeed, her beauty surpassed that of even the most lovely lotus flower. But Venerable Moggallana saw the suffering in her eyes. He knew she had many sorrows in her heart. He stopped and said, "You are indeed beautiful and dressed in the finest garments, but I can see that you are filled with suffering and confusion. Your burden is heavy, yet you continue to pursue a path that leads to even more darkness." Upalavana was taken aback by Moggallana's ability to read her innermost thoughts, but she pretended to be nonplussed and retorted, "Perhaps what you say is true, but this is the only path I have." Moggallana said, "Why be so pessimistic? No matter what your past has been like, you can transform yourself and create a better future. Soiled clothes can be washed. A heart burdened by confusion and weariness can be purified by the waters of enlightenment. The Buddha teaches that everyone has the capacity to awaken and find peace and joy." Upalavana began to weep. "But my life is filled with sinful deeds and injustices. I'm afraid that even the Buddha cannot help me." Moggallana comforted her. "Don't worry. Please share your story with me." Upalavana told Venerable Moggallana that she was the daughter of a wealthy family. She was married at 16. Soon after her husband's father died, her mother-in-law began sleeping with her own son, Upalavana's husband. Upalavana gave birth to a daughter, but unable to endure the incestuous relationship of her husband and mother-in-law, she ran away, leaving her daughter behind. Some years later, she met and married a merchant. When she learned he was secretly keeping a concubine, she investigated until she uncovered the horrible truth that his concubine was the very daughter she had abandoned years earlier. Her pain and bitterness were so great that she began to hate all the world. She no longer loved or trusted anyone. She became a courtesan and sought money, jewels, and material pleasures for solace. She confessed she had even been thinking of trying to seduce Moggallana when he passed by as a means to expose humanity's false virtue. Beautiful Lotus covered her face and sobbed. Moggallana let her cry to ease her pain. Then he spoke to her about the Dharma and took her to meet the Buddha. The Buddha spoke words of comfort to her and asked if she would like to study with the bhikkhunis under the guidance of Abbess Gotami. She was ordained, and after only 4 years of diligent practice, was considered by all an exceptional example for everyone.